This is Michael Coe from the Punk Rock and Politics Podcast, and you're listening to some of the best podcasts available on the internet, only on the No Phony Podcast Network.
Welcome to Heroes Garage, where we preview and review movies and TV shows, not always having to do with superheroes, fantasy, and science fiction, as is the case today when we are slated to review El Camino, which is a drama, a crime drama, would you say, Bill?
Yeah, I think so. It's a it kind of fits that that genre. It could be action drama, I think. I guess to be more specific.
Yeah. So we're excited about
the momentum there.
We are excited about the action and the drama and everything in between, including the comedy.
Oh, true. True that.
So sometimes we do a little banter to kind of warm people up to our voices, and sometimes we just jump right in.
I think so, because this is one of those shows that, you know, we have to jump right in.
So we're going to jump away, and I have some facts for you, Bill, some numbers. So
could you throw that to us.
I will do that. So typically we would talk about box office, but we're going to actually talk about popularity, and we're going to look at how many million viewers did they anticipate watched El Camino on the day of release, which was October 11. And we're going to compare it to another pretty popular Netflix release, which was Bird Box.
Oh, yeah. I forget that one was a pretty big release.
It was, and quite honestly, to our listening audience, that was our biggest podcast review as far as listenership, too.
No, it only makes sense. It only makes sense.
you know, it kind of does, because we're kind of a Netflix review show, and then every now and then we watch a movie.
I think we are. We can't get away from it.
No, we can't.
I think just because they produce the amount of material that they produce is just a lot and is good. So it's the focus. So that's what I think.
To steal a famous line from El Camino, it's what it is.
It's what it is. Yo.
Okay. Yo. Okay. So, popularity. 2.6 million people watched this on October 11, the day of release. In comparison, Bird Box, 3.6 million.
Wow. Bird Box still stands on its own.
Yes, it does. Weekend, El Camino, 6.5 million. And to put that in contrast, I don't have a number to compare to the first week. I don't know why the article didn't have it. We're a couple weeks out, but it is what it is. Uh-huh. Bird Box, there were 26 million viewers in the first week. And we don't have a ton of... Oh, so that's really more about the legs, right? Like, how does this thing have legs? And right. Another way to compare this is how many people watched the Breaking Bad finale back in 2013 or 14. And it was 10.3 million.
Wow.
So this is understandable when you start putting it into that context. As popular as we think a show could possibly be, and as much as we talk about it on Twitter and in podcasts, you're not going to reach the level of popularity of the finale of one of the best TV shows in the history, right?
Yeah, I agree.
You're not. And I think that... Oh, go ahead, Bill.
Well, because there was also a 6-year lag, too, right?
Yeah, right. And I think that's something to keep in mind, not only when you look at popularity, but also when you start, when we start to dive into the review. I think what people need to keep in mind is that Breaking Bad was one of the best shows of all time.
Yeah.
And construction-wise, story narrative-wise, character-wise, everything that we're going to talk about in the review, Breaking Bad is up there amongst the best in history. So is El Camino going to be the best in history? Like, that would be a lot to ask of a follow-up from 6 years later.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So we're trying to get some proper perspective. But you know who always comes in with a perspective, Bill?
Tom?
The critics. The critics always have something to say.
They always have something to say. Very insightful most of the time.
Yes. And some of the time we'll find the cracks in their lack of logic. But today we're probably going to be somewhat in agreement. So the fresh meter on Rotten Tomatoes gives us a 92%, which is a very, very good score.
That's very high, yeah.
And the audience gives it an 82%, which sounds about right.
Yeah, yeah. A little tail off there, huh?
Mm-hmm. So I guess the sophisticated palate ranks this higher.
Mm-hmm.
We'll call it sophisticated this week. That was a dig. You're supposed to laugh heartily at that. There we go. That's my laugh line.
I'm sorry. I forgot the cue. <That's>
like, that was it.
I missed my cue. Sorry. Can we rewind the tape?
I know. What can we do in editing, right?
Right.
Does that surprise you at all, Bill? Anything about that jar you, or does that seem about right?
Not really. I think that, I tend to be more in line with the audience on this. Mm-hmm. Oddly enough, as much as the critics were absolutely fawning over this, which it's interesting, you know, when you look at the breakdown of the movie, and we'll get into it, of critical versus audience, and I think the audience probably found a little more holes to it than the critics did, and the critics gave a little bit more leeway, and I think that that's, you know, that's going to be part of how we're going to kind of break this down from our point of view, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, the demographic, the most it would seem from Nielsen and the studies that they do around all of this stuff, that the average age was between 18 and 49. So that's a 30-year window.
Yeah, there you go.
And I would imagine that a good majority of that would be people that would designate themselves as male.
Right.
Although the article doesn't say that, and the article I am referencing is Adweek.com. So you can go to adweek.com and check my arithmetic here. Basically, I didn't have to add up anything, though, Bill. I just had to read off a sheet of paper.
Yeah, this is already running smoothly.
Yes. So when I think of arithmetic on a social worker level, I would like it just to be read off of something that's already computated.
It just makes things so much easier.
Yes, it does. Okay, so we're going to go through some of the facts here before we dive into the meat of the review. If you're not living on an island, and if you're a fan, you know that this is a Vince Gilligan product.
Yep.
Means he directs it. He writes it. You don't have his pal, good old buddy, old pal, whose name I can't remember. There's a co-writer on a good chunk of the Breaking Bad episodes, and I think all of Better Call Saul has his partner.
Right.
I can't remember his name. I should look that up, or maybe as I'm going through this, Bill, you wouldn't mind looking that up, and I'll...
Already doing it.
You are nice. You're Johnny on the spot here today.
Peter Guild. That's it.
That's it. Peter Guild. Yep.
Yep.
So who does this star, you ask? This stars Aaron Paul as Jesse. Jonathan Banks as Mike. Matt Jones, not the Baltimore Colt quarterback from the 1970s, but the actor as Badger. Charles Baker as Skinny Pete. Todd Terry as Zach Ramey. Julie Pearl as ADA Erickson. Gregory Steven Solis as TV News Anchorman. Larry Hankin as Old Joe, the tow truck driver. Jesse Plemons as Todd. And I think I would bump Todd up to number two on this if I were to.
Yeah, I know. I don't know why he was so, you know, listed so far behind.
that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
He's pretty much the co-star of this thing.
I know, exactly.
Part of the allure, part of the nostalgia, and part of the critique.
Ed is way back in the end, too. So, you know, Ed and Neil and Casey, you know, Scott MacArthur is Neil and Scott Shepherd is Casey and Robert Proctor is Ed. So, yeah, it's the cast really was an interesting order on IMDb. But go on.
Miss and Mr. Pinkman. So played by Tess Harper and Michael Boffshever. I'm sure I got that name correct. So that
sounds like it.
That sounds like it. We're a little slap happy today. We've been looking forward to this. Well, at least we've been talking about it for a while.
Right.
It's up there, right?
Just by being true fans of Breaking Bad, when this came up on the radar, it was very interesting. Honestly, this is my slow segue into our review. I really didn't know that much about it until I saw the trailer and said, oh, this is about Jesse's escape. Because you think about what is the real loose end of Breaking Bad, right? It's not really the, you know, the family, it's, or all the other perpetrators, because they're pretty much all dead. anybody that was a criminal seemed to be dead in this series. But the one left loose end in this would be, what happened to Jesse?
Yeah, since he drove out of the compound, and this show takes up as we dive into the facts of the story. And if you haven't watched this already, spoilers will abound from this point on.
Yep.
We'll have a shameless reveal of everything we can possibly get our minds around. So. We want you to come back, though. We want you to listen to our review. We want you to go on Twitter, at Heroes Garage, or at TJackZ on Twitter, or you can email us, heroesgaragetalk@gmail.com. Let us know what we got right, what we got wrong. Even just your opinion would be wonderful. Yep. So this takes place right after Breaking Bad finale. El Camino, Jesse's riding one. And he is in a hot vehicle, right? Because this is connected to a crime scene. And these guys have been doing really bad meth stuff, amongst other things that we'll get into in the show, for a while. And there's a massive police manhunt for Jesse. They're trying to locate him, not necessarily as a prime suspect as much as it is that he's been identified as an escapee who might have information about the drug in other dealings that have been going on in this compound in Albuquerque. And that's pretty much all I'm going to say about the story, because it's pretty much about his attempt to escape. And interestingly enough, it doesn't involve anything having to do with... Actually, it's not interesting. We knew already it wouldn't have anything to do with Saul Goodman, because Saul escaped, right?
Yeah, Saul made his escape as well. And Walt has met his final end.
Yeah, so that's the biggest, one of the big spoilers here. And we knew that we saw him last, Walter White, laying on a slab of cement in the compound. And we half wondered and half worried, maybe more worried than wondered, that he would crawl back up and throw an apron on at some point. But we learned from this that he does not do that, that he dies. So spoilers. So let's dive into this, Bill. First of all, story. What do you think about the story, just generally speaking?
So generally speaking, I mean, it is Jesse's, where is he going to go? What's he going to do? And, you know, he escaped. He is going to some old pals to help him at least get on his feet, to figure out what is his next course of action, what he's going to take. And, you know, that in itself is always a great story. It's a true convict or prisoner escaping a prison or compound. I always found that those type of movies interesting. It, you know, they're on the run, so to speak, right? And there's always creativity involved in it. I think that there's a lot of creative liberty that's involved when you do an escapee type movie. And of course, you have some boundaries that you have to stay within because, of course, we already know who Jesse is, right? We already know where he's at, where he's located. And we also know through just flashbacks that he has to, get somewhere that he's never going to be recognized as well. So yeah. I like that premise. I think that some great movies have always been made that are escape convict type movies. And so that is a premise, I think makes me enjoy this movie better because you got to see how it's naturally going to progress. It's not going to be fake. You really don't want to fake it. You want to kind of just let the character on his own and see where it goes, right?
Yeah. And they do some things in here to pull in the audience without, like you said, they can't be too on the nose with this because we already know enough and we would be bored silly if they did too much of it. Right. But you have some returning characters like Skinny Pete and Badger. And so he kind of makes his way to them. And it just makes sense.
Who I must say is Skinny Pete, even though it was 6 years, was the one character that still looks like Skinny Pete.
Everybody else had fat face syndrome going on, but not Skinny Pete.
Skinny Pete. I don't know what this guy, he's got some problems. But man, he was in character.
Yeah, he was. And those things kind of serve a couple of purposes in a film like this, which has an already built-in audience with already built-in expectations, is one part nostalgia, right? Like you want to have a connection to something. It helps you to feel what you felt when you were watching Breaking Bad. But then it also makes sense within the storyline because who else would he run to, right?
Right. Well, who else is alive that he would run to?
Right.
You know, I mean, he's not going to go to his parents. He's got to get the remaining dealers out of the way, or friends that are at least know him. Yeah. And so it makes sense that those were the two that he would visit first, right?
Yeah,
and we truly see a broken man.
Yeah, you do. And you see Skinny Pete and Badger living the way they live and how they've always lived, right, which is kind of a familiar, comfortable place. And when you just said the last thing that you said, it actually reminded me of the feeling of this feels a little bit, I struggle at a metaphor here, so I'm going to just go with what's in my mind. It feels like a Hail Mary. It's like you have this solitary ex-drug dealer escaping, and Walter White's gone. His connections are gone. He's got these two kids that are barely older than teenagers, although they look like they're 35 in this.
I think he's probably older.
Maybe they're in their mid-20s. I don't know.
They could be in their 30s. They could be just this riffraff that never has let go. It's what I kind of picture these guys as.
Yeah. So like the timetable, I guess if you tried to map this out and figure out what our timetable is, like Jesse's like a senior in high school when this thing starts and, you know, six seasons later, you know, but time does funny things in TV shows. But when he's in escaping, it feels like the emotional feeling of this. And if you don't actually feel it, it might make sense to go back and watch the last season, which is only like six episodes of Breaking Bad, just to get back into that headspace that Jesse was in when he escaped in that El Camino. That's where he is going to at the start of this movie.
Yeah, I mean, you definitely look at him as a tortured prisoner, right? And he's acting like a tortured prisoner, and that's how we get him and we see him. Because he has been living in these conditions that are just absolutely horrid. His mental state has been crushed. He's seen some brutal things that have just mounted to this, this feeling, an explosion of I'm out finally. And you see him just laugh and and how he is just elated, and then quickly he gets in survivor mode.
Yeah, because he's got PTSD symptoms. He's got flashbacks. He's got nightmares. He's got trauma reminders going on that pull him back into these memories of the compound. And that's another vehicle. So one part makes sense, right? Because it's symptoms of PTSD. Turning to the film critic. Is, okay, this is also a function of the way they're telling the story, right? This is not a trope, but it's a tactic to try and tell more story.
Yeah, I mean, it's you're in his head. What they're trying to do is really get in his head and understand what he's experiencing. It's almost as if, you know, some criminal that's been, or any person that's been in, you know, caught and been incarcerated and tortured for a long time, have that sense of freedom. So think about the things that he's going through is that he has all this trauma, all this emotional wear, this physical wear on his body. He's escaped. And then lastly, he has to get his faculties all together to figure out what is his next move. Yeah. And I think that's what's so cool is how Badger and Skinny Pete really rescue him and get him straightened out in that state, the way that they do the car exchange, the way that they set the cops up and get really Jesse into the next step. Is that he had the breakout. Now it's okay, you know, we'll cover for you this part, but now, you know, you have to kind of follow these instructions and go this way. And I like that, how he kind of got himself together, through the shower, you know, getting himself cleaned up, and he feels now he's ready. He looks determined. He's out of that traumatic state. And now he seems purposeful, and I like that transformation.
And just piggybacking on that and adding to what you said is just what I think is so great, and what makes Vince Gilligan, I think, a really good writer, is that the kindness shown by Skinny Pete sacrificing himself potentially to give Jesse his freedom, and doing it in a criminally, like a street criminal way that makes sense.
Right.
And it also is probably one of my favorite lines of this entire movie comes out there, where Skinny Pete's talking to Badger and he's talking to Jesse. He's pretty much telling everybody what the scoop is. Okay, this is how we're going to get you free. Take my car. Jesse, you take my car. I'll take the El Camino. We're going to stay here, and when the police come, I'm going to say that you stopped by, you smoked a little pot, and you left. And he says, I can pass any lie detector test because it is, quote unquote, what it is, right? It's what it is, right? He's telling a lie in the most believable way, because it is basically what happened.
Yeah, he said, you know, that's what's so funny. Yeah, I love the Skinny Pete thing. And what I like, they had some consistency of timeline here, because when he asked them to, you know, when Skinny Pete gives him his wad of cash, and then he looks at Badger and, you know, he's like, you gonna help him out? You know, he sticks out his wad of cash and give it to him. And if you recall, that's the same wad of cash that Walt gave them to do the laser beams.
Nice.
And so there was a continuity here that, of course, these guys don't have a wallet, they don't have banks. They're just going to keep the cash on them. So who knows how long it was from there, but they had that big wad of cash.
Mm-hmm. I love that. And that's Vince Gilligan. That's what he does.
I love that too.
The kindness, I think, kind of helps Jesse. It helps to mobilize his determination to move forward and to escape even that much more, because he kind of feeds off that kindness. So he goes from there. And that's where the flashbacks do something else. Not only do they inform us about the PTSD, they also help drive the story narrative. And you've talked about this before, Bill, where they'll use either a flashback where you're actually looking backward to move a story forward.
Yeah, it's because the clues that it's like if you have a character that all of a sudden shows up in the scene and starts doing something and it doesn't make any sense, there's not a continuity of story. So that's why they do a flashback, is to show exactly when Jesse's in his in the next part of I believe he's in sneaking into Todd's apartment, right?
Right.
And you know, there's a reason why he's going there, and that whole flashback scene is now, you know, you're driving Jesse to make these decisions. And so the flashback covers, and not only just that decision, but there's also a row of decisions. Now, what did you think about the flashback scene with Todd? Because that carried a big chunk of the story. If it wasn't for all those flashbacks with Todd, it seems like we would have a much shorter film.
We wouldn't have a movie in a lot of ways. Well, at least the movie they gave us, right? We would have a different movie. I would imagine. That was funnier in my own head than it was probably to the listening audience. Okay, so Todd, the visual aesthetic is an adjustment. He is F-A-T fat. I mean, his face is fat, his belly is fat, his face is deformed. He looks like he's been sitting around a compound eating pepperoni pizzas for a good decade, if not
actually
more.
Actually, I refer to as bacon and bean soup.
Yeah. This was that. It was, so that is a little jarring.
Little? Come on, you're being, that's being kind. It was completely jarring.
I
was like, wow, Todd must have been popping it in and out of a thyroid problem.
Well, the thing is, though, let me say this, though. What's funny about that is, okay, so you have that. That's problematic. It is problematic. There's no way around it. The visual is problematic. But within that, Gilligan throws in these story pieces that are part tragic, part hilarious. So they go to this apartment, and they're there to dispose of a body, right?
Right,
and
right.
To make this a little easier and make it harder for them to get caught, they have to put this cover on the El Camino, which he needs Jesse's help doing. So Todd brings Jesse along to do all of this, and on the way back, and this is so funny, I didn't catch it till I watched this the second time, and I watched it twice, is they're playing this song in the El Camino, and Todd's driving, he's up front alone, in back in the El Camino is a dead body that's been sitting there I don't know how long next to Jesse.
Yes, yeah, and he's singing the entire song.
And Todd is singing that song like the Mac Daddy. Like, no, if you want to know what sociopathic behavior looks like, look at Todd.
Oh, it was so funny. I thought it was hysterical because Todd, to me, was an evil Lenny. And when I say Lenny, I'm talking about Lenny and Mice and Men.
Yes.
Where, you know, Lenny wasn't too bright and he needed to, you know, some guidance. Well, it's the same who Todd is Todd's not so bright. He needs some guidance, but he's twisted.
Yeah, he is.
He's impulsive. And I think that's part of, even though, you know, Vince Gilligan was like, yeah, the actor's overweight, but I want you to see that Todd's still impulsive. He still makes those stupid decisions that he thinks is okay.
He seems like he feels like a psychopath. Like,
yeah,
you're being kind on one end. Like, okay, so this, before I get in, well, anyways, there's an incongruence here, right?
Break it down.
He's got this stuff that looks like kindness while he's murdering the housemaid because he doesn't want to get caught for the crimes he's committing. And he doesn't have any emotional dip at all with that. It's just, well, she did this, so I got to kill him. Boom, done.
Right. Yeah.
That's psychopathic. Like, there's no empathy at all. It's just all in service of his agenda and himself. That just feels psychopathic. And then you have this
perfectionism, right? Of him is just to react violently.
And then you get to a point, which I want to get your opinion on, Bill, because we talked about this in pre-production a couple of days ago, is we get to one of the potentially problematic scenes in this, right? It's Jesse finding the handgun, Todd and Jesse squaring off, and Jesse's got the weapon. Todd does not. And just what did you think about that scene? And do you feel like it fit continuity wise with those two characters?
Yeah, I think that was pretty much the biggest problem. And I think they actually tried to even cover up the problem when Jesse meets the two fake cops, right? When he's taking the money out of Todd's apartment, and how he didn't off one of the guys and decided against it. And it was kind of, they're trying to show a consistency of Jesse, you know, not wanting to harm people anymore, which isn't consistent because
no,
when
not even
gun,
in this movie,
not even in this movie. Yeah. That's even flash forward, but I'm even talking about when the machine gun went off. What did Jesse do when Todd looked outside the window as he grabbed his chain and wrapped it around Todd's neck and choked him?
He killed him.
And it wasn't like he had to think much about it. It was like, I'm killing Todd, you know?
We loved it at the time. I mean,
we loved it at the
truly,
time. But it was what, you know, it's what he had to do, right?
Yeah, right.
Well, so to learn that Jesse had a gun in the desert and is treated like a mutilated dog, and he doesn't raise it to point at Todd, I'm kind of like, okay, I'm not really buying this. And I think this to me was an inconsistency of that relationship. I mean, Todd's, all of a sudden Todd basically Jesse was won over by Todd because you know what I mean? It's like, that's not true. And even Jesse was even thinking, I need to escape. I need to get out of this. You know, I don't know. The only thing, Tom, I could think of is what Jesse wouldn't do it is thinking about the little boy of what would happen to him. Mm. That was it Brock, I think, that is the kid's name. That's the only thing that he was contemplating of not shooting him would be, would this kid get killed? But I don't know.
They didn't connect that dot in
they didn't connect that dot at all. And so I saw that as a flaw. I think that especially you do a flashback sequence and you're showing a character who is traumatized, obviously. But he was more traumatized when he escaped than he was under the situation. I mean, he was obviously experiencing the trauma, but here was his golden ticket to go and he didn't take it. And I think they try to kind of cover it up a couple times in here and with this flashback that Vince Gilligan wanted to make a point of like, no, Jesse's character's beat up. He's subdued. He's no longer the junkyard dog. He's under the master's thumb. He's in chains and he can't even defend himself.
The only thing I could think of that is consistent, and I'm going to say this just for the sake of argument, and I don't really believe what I'm about to say, but I'll say it anyway. Those are the best things to say live on mic, things you don't believe. I'm wondering if they're trying to tell us that what is consistent here is like literally in the moment, not trying to track it from situation to situation, but literally in the moment. The thing that impacts Jesse the most is some sort of empathic connection or disconnection or disconnect from the person he's encountering, right?
Right.
That doesn't track well at all. Yeah, well, in layman's terms is you felt empathy for Todd because he uses all of his psychopathic charm on Jesse in the desert.
Right.
So he says, hey, I got a pizza. Hey, let's just chill out and have a beer. You know, I'm thinking about it. Like Todd says it in a way that if you're an empathic person, you're like, wow, he's thinking about me. He's thinking about taking care of me. He's going to do something for me, you know, that kind of thing. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. Maybe there's that kind of thing going on later on when the two should have been caught, the people that weren't cops, and he doesn't shoot them either.
Right.
That he doesn't do for a different reason, though. So that doesn't work.
Yeah,
that doesn't work. I don't know that that works at all. That's a flaw.
It's a flaw. Because even Jesse starts crying when he hands over the gun because I think he I think what he's trying to show him there is that he knew he had to do it, but he couldn't do it. And for some reason, unbeknownst to us, we're missing that. I feel like we're not really given enough, information other than the one who is kidnapped is attached to their kidnappers.
Yeah, there's a syndrome named after that I can't remember. Yeah,
Stockholm syndrome.
Yeah, Stockholm syndrome. Yeah, so, where you just want to obey what your captors tell you to do.
Exactly.
That could have been that.
I mean, it tripped me up a little bit. I didn't buy it. Todd as the actor, I was like, okay, was he in a role that he had to gain that much weight, and at least he could have tried to lose at least 10 pounds? I don't know.
The thing that flashback does do that I'm glad, despite the discrepancy, is it keeps the narrative somewhat clunking along.
Yeah.
And it keeps moving towards one of the best scenes in this entire movie.
Yeah, it does.
Which is the encounter between Jesse. Flash forward. So we're talking to an audience that we're assuming has watched this and knows exactly what we're talking about. So you know when we're talking about a flashback and when we're talking about the present day. So the next scene is a present day scene where he goes back to meet these former employees of the compound group. And two of them have money that Jesse found in Todd's old apartment. And Jesse needs to get that so that he can get enough money to pay this other character. What's his name? Lou?
Ed.
To pay Ed.
That whole transition was really cool. I mean, the fact that there was a lot of mind play going on with the money exchange and how Jesse still ended up with a third of the cash and the other guys left and no one got shot and everybody moved and Jesse recognized the truck.
Yeah.
But the next play I thought was really cool is that he went to go to see Ed at the vacuum store. And so what car, Tom, little trivia, was parked outside of the vacuum store?
Well, I did see the van, but they made it a huge point for all of us to see the van, the red burgundy van. So I'm sure you're not referring to that car.
No. I think that was the same car that Walt got dropped off in.
Yes.
But there was another car sitting there. Did you see the other car that was sitting there?
I did, but did not make a mental note of it. So it I'm out.
It was Saul's beater car.
His little yellow beater?
Yes.
Oh, that's awesome.
I know. I was like, oh, that's a nice tip your hat. And that kind of made the little bit understanding of who Ed was, because you kind of get the feeling that Saul's departure was not that long ago. Before Jesse's, because the car was still there. Ed didn't have time to dispose the car yet.
Yeah.
So I thought that from a timeline perspective, that was really cool. I really liked that. And I liked Ed a lot. I liked how that whole exchange of Jesse was short with the cash, and then he gives him the car and he goes, it's your word. And Ed, is like, yep, that's my word. It's like, that's his job, right?
Right.
So I loved that whole, I loved Ed. Ed was a great character. I really liked him.
That was an awesome scene.
But he was short on cash.
Yes, he was. So he needs to go and find. So who has cash?
Mom and Dad.
Yes, they do, potentially. So he does what any good addict would do, or ex-addict. Although that's a huge judgment on my part, and I do apologize for saying that is kind of cruel, because a lot of people go through cycles in their life where they're addicted and they break out of them and they take on new patterns. They live a different lifestyle. Jesse doesn't do that. Jesse maintains some of his old patterns.
Yeah.
And so he calls up his parents and lies to them, gets them to go to a location where he says he's going to turn himself in, but he uses that as an opportunity to break into the house and try and find money.
Which wasn't there.
No, it wasn't, which was true to form, right? He hasn't really gotten satisfied with interactions with his parents for a good while for Jesse.
But he finds two weapons, one being a 1911 Luger, and another one like a 22. That was funny. So then he goes and confronts.
Bill, you're helping a lot here on this, actually. I'm trying to jump to the scene, the standoff, but there were things that happened before that. So Now we finally get to the standoff.
Now we get to the standoff at the welding place, right? Where these other guys had 2/3 of the money that was stashed. And Jesse's kind of just showing up just for what? Honestly, I just want a couple grand. It's all I want, Jesse is saying.
Yeah.
And and this was the time I said, it was about an hour into the movie, Tom, that this was in. And I said, oh, good. Here comes some action.
I know, right?
I was like, oh, please give me some action. The whole Todd thing kind of was dragging a little bit. And I don't know if it was some sentimentality. I know it was setting us up. There was some nostalgia there. I just thought it went a little too long to finally get to this scene, which was very exciting. What did you think of it?
You know what? I love the scene. I love that it was kind of a callback to the 1800s and just standoffs in the old streets of Albuquerque. a good old-fashioned gunfight. You know, draw. Whoever wins the draw wins the fight and gets the cash. And
yep.
I love, my favorite thing about this scene, though, is how many shots are fired that hit nothing. That, my friends, is a good and honest actual gunfight. That's exactly what a gunfight would look like.
I thought you were going to say how many shots were fired that could never exist inside one gun.
Well, that's a given, but if you've ever fired a weapon before, I grew up in the rural part of northern Wisconsin, and weapons were a regular part of living up there, and we did a lot of shooting, and it's hard to hit anything if you're not really practicing. We would spend time, you know, we would have, everything was done safety wise. My stepdad was really good with weapons. He taught us really well. We were very careful, but you can't imagine how hard it is to hit something if you're not practicing. And my pet peeve when these shows is you have a kid who's been locked up in a compound, has never really practiced with a weapon. You have these guys around them that aren't, you know, I don't get any sense that they're any good with weapons. And I was so happy when they were all just shooting and missing.
Yeah, it was hysterical. Yeah, I like that it was a true standoff, how Jesse had one gun revealed and the other gun is not. And it was a typical outlaw type of approach. I loved it. I loved everything about it. I loved the gun battle. I loved the ducking of bullets and everybody's missing and going for the other gun. And just it was great. I loved it. You're right. It captured a Western perfectly. Even just how he just torches the place too was so Breaking Bad. And I think that to me just really like, oh yeah, I'm watching a Breaking Bad movie. And I think that was, to me, was the pinnacle point of, okay, this is a Breaking Bad. That's what I felt.
This movie, that was like, it's like a flight to St. Louis, right?
Right.
It took about 45 minutes to get off the air. It hits its peak in the warehouse with this gun battle. And then it starts the descent.
It starts the descent. True. Yeah. Because right after that is, Jesse now has the cash to make the connection. And to really, it's the second phase of his escape, right?
Yeah.
Now he has everything he needs. And then we get another flashback scene, right?
Yes, we do.
And
we
now
get a scene of
explain this one.
Let's see, because I've been chronologically challenged tonight in this review, but my recollections have him sitting at a diner with Walter White.
That would be the one, right? Oh. And I thought, now granted that Jesse was a little bit a bigger guy, I think the coat helped his age. But Walt looked like Walt, man. Boy, he came through. That's a professional actor right there, Tom.
Yeah, it's, he didn't like, look 45 pounds overweight and baked bean soup and all that stuff. He looked like he was he was battling cancer and he was skinny and he was coughing.
Yep. Yep. He owned that scene. That scene was awesome. I love that scene.
He was patronizing in only the Walt way.
Oh, I loved it. I love the whole banter back and forth. I love how Jesse was really not that mature. He was still, you know, like a gangbanger, drug dealer, street drug dealer guy.
Wannabe.
Yep. Yep. And it was their first score. And if you think about it, Tom, what would it have been like if that was where it ended? And I think that's why they chose that scene, is life would have been a lot different for Jesse if they just stopped right there. And
yeah, nice catch.
Mm-hmm.
That's a nice catch, because that's really what made all of these other shows possible, is this relationship, the dyad, right, between Walt and Jesse, and right. how they kind of fed off of each other and needed each other. And they were such a duo. And when they're sitting at the diner, I totally saw, good catch, Bill.
Yeah.
So they go from there, and I can't even remember the next sequence. I'm assuming he goes back to Ed and gets transported up to Alaska. But am I missing anything?
They have the flashback with Jessica Jones. So.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Which you forget, like, oh, yeah, that's right. Just that was Jessica Jones.
Which highlights another potential weakness in this, which the nostalgic flashbacks. It was Force Awakens grade nostalgia in parts.
Explain that, Tom.
Well, one of the biggest critiques of Force Awakens is it's just built on nostalgia and not much of a story, except for what's been borrowed from movies that were made 30 years ago. And with this, there is a little bit of that struggle in here for us, right? Like, there's nostalgia that feels really good, and it moves the story and it does something. And then there's nostalgia that feels overly, it reaches. And that some of that felt like reaching a little bit to me.
Yeah, I mean, I understand. Since he was kind of living in the flashback, of course she would be in there and be part of it. He moves into with Ed, and finally his getaway in Alaska. The part that just languished the most was with Todd. There's just too much of Todd, I felt.
Yeah.
There could have been a good half hour cut out of that.
Or even have another way to fill in the gaps and different kind of flashback bits. Because Todd, the visual aesthetic really was a buzzkill. It really was off.
Yeah. He has that look because of just his hair color and his forehead and his face and, you know, how he's slanted out. He has that look that there is that sociopath look to him. But here it was like a pumpkin head sociopath look. And,
it was too much. It didn't work.
It was too much. I mean, Todd is a very uncomfortable character in Breaking Bad, and it just didn't come across that well. But how do you feel about the ending? Like he was hiding in the truck, and now he has his own truck, and Ed's quizzing him about who he is. What did you feel? Was there a payoff for you, Tom?
Not hugely. I like the visual, because we're clear of Todd, and we're now into other visuals. And just the open Alaska roads and the mountains and the snow and the kind of the loneliness of it. It felt a little bit like the loneliness that Walt was in when he was in his cabin in New England somewhere. This felt like it had more loneliness because there's more wide open space in Alaska than there is in Massachusetts. And you could feel it in the space, but I guess you can see how the way I'm struggling with it, I'm struggling to find like a lot of really good words for it. And to me, maybe that didn't really land as much for me as maybe it did for other people.
Yeah, I liked it, but I could understand, is this something that's true to his character, right? Think he's going from Albuquerque to Alaska. Now, that's quite a weather change. Hot desert to freezing cold, but you know, maybe he bought into Mike's little story when he asked him what would he would do and where would he go. And Mike said, I would go to Alaska or you do me. He goes, I don't know. You go do whatever you want. He goes, no. He goes, Alaska. I would go to Alaska because there's, you know, and Mike explains why, and Jesse's holding on to that. So, and I who knows, after, and this part of the PTSD of everything with Jesse is, does he just want to be alone? Just want to, you know, relax and be this person and get in and sucked into a community. Cause there's still going to be a city, still going to be a village, and he's still going to be a part of it, but it's just not going to be what he is used to. And
yeah, I think I've watched too many reality shows because this is where my brain goes with that. I like the connection to Banks, to Mike. That fits, right? Because Jesse doesn't have a mind of his own. That's why he followed, you know, Walter into the abyss. And so that all fits, like, just to listen to Mike,
and Mike,
right?
And Gus, if you want to just throw that in there, too.
That all fits. What I don't like is there's a lot of substance abuse in Alaska. It's cold, and he's just going to be drinking and getting involved with people that he was involved in Albuquerque, only in a different part of the country. It just doesn't...
It's so funny. So you're saying he's going to relapse?
He's going to relapse. He's not going to go up there and, like, sit on a porch and smell the fresh air.
So let me kind of tie this up in a bow for you here. It's basically, it's only a matter of time, right?
Yeah, I mean, he's going to be on a fishing boat. He's going to get sick of it because he can't really do it. He's going to be seasick all the time, and everyone's going to be mad at him because he can't do his job. They're going to kick him off the boat, and he's going to be in Fairbanks or somewhere else wandering around looking for work. And bada bing, bada boom, he's going to land on some scheme to make money because that's all he ever does. Jesse's right back where he was.
That is too funny. Well, he does have a bag full of cash, but how long is he really going to? It's going to, he could probably milk that out for a while in Alaska, I would think.
I don't think he has the skills to.
You don't think so? He really does. You're right. He doesn't have any skills.
No, he doesn't have any skill set. Like, what's he going to do in Alaska?
Like, that's... Walt was saying is, like, you know, you should get a business degree. Well,
which puts him right back in the same boat because that's the only business he knows, right?
Don't you think that maybe that's what Jesse's going to do is go back to college? He's going to take some, you know, maybe like some Phoenix online courses and get his degree?
Or, yeah, to Fairbanks Polytechnical University. I mean, that could happen.
He could get into taxidermy. You don't know. You don't know.
And that probably lends itself to the problem. So I read a quote. So... The quote is from Aaron Paul, and he pretty much says that this is the end of the road. There's no plans for any future Breaking Bad movies. This is it.
Thank goodness.
So, there is such a thing as a shelf life, and there is such a thing as a time for all things to end. And this does feel like a time for it to end. And I guess shipping somebody off to Alaska is probably a good way to kind of end things because it's kind of an unknown for most of us. And just, he went to Alaska.
Wasn't that usually the threat from dad if you weren't behaving at the table? Watch it, I'll ship you off to Alaska.
For me, it was he's going to ship me off to the machine shop to work, to get on the lathe. Well, I'm going to have you get to do the work I was supposed to be doing this afternoon.
I think in wrapping this up, the one little sentimental piece that we didn't talk about and we could wrap it up in our review here was the letter that he gives to Ed that was listed to Brock. And I did read online. It was to the kid, the little kid that, his mother was shot by Todd. And, it was Jesse, one of Jesse's plans to settle down. And it was a letter written to the kid. Now the alternative ending to it was there was a voiceover of Jesse narrating what was written in the letter. But Vince Gilligan decided to edit that out and put this ending in. What do you think about that ending as a narration to the kid? Is that a loose knot that a loose end that need to be tied up.
I like that they're tying it back to this human contact, right? Because that's when you get down to it, people need people. We learned that from Barbra Streisand, I think, in 1967. And it's true. Like, people do need people.
First, folks.
And I like that. It's a touching, thoughtful, sensitive, kind of connecting thing. We have to remember, and it's sometimes hard to do so because this film is so much after, later, you know, 6 years after the finale, that that would have been in his headspace at that time in the timeline.
Right.
That he wants to take care of Brock. And that could feel like a something that would stick in his craw a little bit as far as guilt and shame would be around this happening.
He's getting away from this and letting this kid live in this
world
of being an orphan.
And basically this happened because of me, like, directly exactly. Because of me. I pulled your mom into this and she died because of this. I could see that being an underlying reason why he would start drinking in Alaska. But I like it that they didn't do the voiceover narration. I think that would have been a little bit too sappy for me.
I was going to say, it'd be completely hokey, I believe. Yeah. You don't need that type. It doesn't, you know, Breaking Bad did not have any type of cutesy, you know, type of reminiscing or thought-provoking conclusions of some storyline. You just had to see it. Here's a letter. You know, whatever's in the letter, maybe he hid some money for the kid. Maybe, you know, we don't know. And quite frankly, it's good not to know. But the beauty of it is that he was thinking of him. There's something that's there. Even Ed appeared to be moved by it, too.
Yeah.
I felt he could see Ed because Ed's hardcore.
Yeah, he is.
He was even in the vacuum store like, yeah, what do you think? I'm going to get a sentimental here. Get out, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. He's been doing this a while.
He's been doing this a while. And so, but I like that that didn't end that way. Okay. So here I get to play Tom.
Okay.
In the ratings, you know, I always have the ratings. You have the payoff. Your payoff seems like it wasn't as strong.
Mm-hmm.
But if you were to give it a rating, where would you rate this?
You know what? I didn't have the strong payoff. You are absolutely correct. So some of the payoffs for me was the return to the visual aesthetic of the Vince Gilligan produced, directed, and written show. I love that. Just the shot angle, the cinematography. I love the music. Just perfectly, the music that they choose for these is just wonderful. I like the little touching elements where they do these flashbacks and they connect to this human connection. Even when it doesn't make sense, like with Todd and Jesse in the desert, you still can appreciate that it's all built on this connection between two characters. And I think that's the strength of Vince Gilligan's writing in some ways. I think he understands petty criminals pretty well, so I don't know what that says about his past. but it lacked the major over-the-top payoff that I would have wanted.
Right.
There was some
like a machine gun set in the car and rattling off and killing everybody inside, that type of payoff.
And I think, part of the problem here is we start to learn that Jesse is a real good sidekick, but he's not Walter White. And it would have been hard for him to carry this for an extended period of time, like a series, because it just wouldn't have captured our interest enough.
Right.
And I think that's probably part of the problem with this as well. So my rating is going to be like 7.5 to 8. It was good. It wasn't bad by any stretch. It was good. It wasn't a consolation good. Like, oh, was that? It was good. It's not a consolation good. It was legitimately a good. But it's not something that I'm going to say, oh, go watch El Camino. You have to. It's just.
Right.
You know, if you've watched all of this, you've invested your time in Breaking Bad and you're watching Better Call Saul the day they come out on, then run out and watch this. But otherwise, I would say it was good. So right around 7.5 for me. How about you, Bill?
I liked Aaron Paul's performance. I think it really shows himself as a really good actor for this character. He really does a great job with Jesse. I think I didn't feel like 1 minute I've distracted about a 6-year lag. I felt like I was getting Jesse as if it was he was escaping the compound 6 years ago. So for me in that part, I didn't have doubt. It wasn't as disruptive as Todd and who he was. And there was definitely some lag there and dragging a story. I felt they went way too long on. It had definitely the Breaking Bad elements, more storyline. But again, just definitely what you're saying. I felt I when I finished it, I was like, oh, that was good. And it wasn't a consolation good. It wasn't like, oh, that's great. That was, you know, I'm glad they made this and there's this huge payoff. But I did leave it going, okay, that was good. And I felt, I didn't feel like it was a waste of time. I didn't feel, as they could have done things better. Sometimes I could critique that because I understood why they did everything that they did. But I did like it. I give it about 7.5 would be my score, yeah, overall.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and like you said, it's not, you know, when you get Breaking Bad and then you went into Better Call Saul and how great Better Call Saul is just from a storyline, and El Camino is kind of floating out there different from the Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. Yeah. I don't feel that it rises above those two at all, no, but it's like, you know how books have the appendix part, yeah, of it.
Yeah.
And it could be other stories within the story to refer. That's what El Camino felt like.
Yeah. An epilogue, maybe.
Epilogue. That's what I meant. Yeah.
It was epilogical.
It was epilogical.
So that is our review of El Camino, Bill.
Oh, wow. We made it.
We did it. So guess what is looming in the near future for us?
There are other things to talk about. I think there is a Zombieland 2, I know.
Yes.
But also there's some trailers that have dropped.
Yes, there is. And I'm thinking, so you're going to see Zombieland fairly soon, correct?
Fairly soon, yes. Yeah, I plan, okay, to. That's on my radar in the next few days. But I think that, you know, I did not watch any of the trailers. And you know why I didn't watch it? You're going to find this strange. I don't want to know any more of the story. I want to be surprised.
Yeah. Well, you're a good reader of trailers. I can honestly say that most trailers don't spoil things for me because I get in the movie. I'm like, well, that wasn't even in the movie. I'm too literal for the way they do trailers. Like, I didn't see that scene in the movie.
I'm going to go into the trailer because, you know, they've been dropping these trailers and it's been pieces, you know?
Yeah.
It's like a puzzle. And if I watch this last trailer, I'm going to fit this as a puzzle and get it. And I don't want to get it. So I am purposely, you don't know how hard it's been for me to not watch this last trailer.
I'm going to watch the trailer. I've been watching all the trailers because I feel like I've already figured out what's going to happen in this. And I'm just there for the ride now. Like,
gotcha.
If they don't do what I think is going to happen and what everybody, well, not everybody, that's pretty generalizing.
I think you're right.
I mean, at the end of the,
I think what everybody is on the same page.
At the end of the day, Rey's on top, but there is no on top. And right, there is no good or bad in the Force. There's right, just the Force.
Right.
And it's, but Rey is the shining light at the end of the tunnel. Anything wow, other than that is going to be a disappointment. You don't want her to go to the dark side and become a Sith Lord and then fight Kylo Ren, who now suddenly has a blue lightsaber instead of a red one. You know, I don't know that we want all that to happen. We just want it to go the way we think it should go. So,
okay.
You didn't ask for that.
That was our mini trailer review without really discussing the trailer.
Or having even seen the trailer. So, yeah, the best way to review a trailer. So, probably Zombieland will be the next discussion. It will be our 100th episode, though, Bill.
Wow.
Hard to believe.
Oh, my goodness.
So, we'll have that to contend with, all that inertia and weight on our shoulders.
I feel it already.
So, but Bill, I think that's going to put a bow on this episode.
All right, let's put a bow on it.
So for now and until next time, this has been Heroes Garage.
Bye now. Oh,